I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. According to a new report by the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service, about 68 million American adults do not have a bank account. The new report found that together they paid some $89 billion in fees and interest in 2012 because they used alternative financial services. The report floated the idea of allowing the post office to offer some banking services like prepaid cards, small loans and saving accounts to these, quote, unbanked customers. It would save them money and also help the cash-strapped postal service. We wanted to see what Lisa Servan thought of this idea. She's a professor at the Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. She spent 4 months working at a cash checking service in the Bronx as part of her research on low-income communities. And Lisa Servan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I have to say, your picture of this check cashing service, Right Check, in I guess it was the South Bronx, is a very different picture from the one that I had about these companies basically charging high rates to these poor customers and ripping them off.
Mine too. I did not expect to have the experience that I had.
Well, and what you describe is are the people working at this particular service where you worked in the South Bronx having a very personal relationship with their customers that they seem to know very, very well.
That's right. I think one of the differences as banking has really changed and become much more electronic on ATMs, in fact, if you go to a bank these days, this happened to me very recently, and I was waiting in line to do something at the teller window, which I probably do only once or twice a year. There was actually somebody in the bank kind of trying to move me to the ATM in order to really ease the use of people at tellers. And so people go to the bank and use the teller very infrequently, whereas the people who come to a check casher are often coming in, you know, a couple of times a week. And because of that, they really know the people that they're working with, and they really trust the check casher in a way that they don't trust banks.
But they are charged a high interest rate, yes?
Well, you know, one thing to understand is that there's a real difference between check cashers and payday lenders. Payday lenders, for example, and that's where the interest would come in, are illegal in New York State and 15 states in total. And I did work at a payday lender in California, too. So the rates are determined by the state, and in New York they're actually relatively low. For cashing a check, you pay 1.95% of the face value of the check. People also use money orders. They buy money orders, which cost 89 cents at the place that I worked at, Right Check, which is actually cheaper than it is at the post office right now. I believe it's $1.20. And also paid bills or sent money to other countries. And those kinds of things, paying bills, certainly that's one of the things the post office is talking about doing. It cost about $1.50 to pay a bill. And then, you know, the wire transfers to other countries, which you can't do so easily at a bank, maybe cost more than that. But oftentimes what the customers are doing is really making a not just a convenience calculation and a service calculation, but actually a financial calculation. And given that they don't have that much money to put into a checking account and keep there, and the fact that minimum balances have gone up and that overdraft fees have gone up as well at banks, they're not so sure that they can avoid the overdraft fee. And paying that 1.95% plus the bill paying is actually less costly for them than it often would be to have a bank account.
Let me go back to this Inspector General report from the U.S. Postal Service. On average, underserved households spends $2,412 each year just on interest and fees for what they call alternative financial services. These would be not banks. That is a lot of money, and that's certainly a lot of money if you're a low-income person.
It's absolutely a lot of money. I mean, I liken it to the fact that low-income people pay more for almost everything because of their inability to buy in bulk, their need to use convenience stores instead of going to a big market or a Costco like many of us can go to. And so they're paying a premium because they're often their income is exceeding their expenses are exceeding their income. They're having a real difficult time timing when their money comes in and when the money has to go out to pay the bills, and that's often what's driving their need to to use these alternative financial services because other options are not available to them.
But do you see then the payday lenders, that's the real problem when it comes to these high rates and fees?
Yeah, I mean, again, the payday lenders' interest rates are regulated by the states. They vary a lot from state to state, actually. Where I worked in California, the fee to borrow was $15 per hundred, which is pretty high if you use it as in an APR, if you convert it to an APR. What the problem is that most people don't have anywhere else to go. So, you know, the classic story is of someone who, let's say, their car breaks down and they need the car to get to work. They don't have a credit card. They may not qualify. They don't have family and friends they can ask for a loan. And the trade-off that they're making in their mind is either I get some money to fix my car or I lose my job because I can't get to work. So they're really in a bind. That's where the payday loan comes in. The problem is that given their income stream, that expense, that fixing the car, is usually an unexpected blip in their expenses. Right. And there's never a sort of corresponding blip in their income, right, to cover it. So when they go to pay that loan back in 2 weeks, they need to take another loan out or roll it over because they don't have the money to pay it back in full.
You describe, and as I said, there were some surprising things in some of your writing about the kind of customer-client relationship, the kind of family feel that you described at this particular check cashing place.
Right, right. Yeah, it kind of goes back to the fact that that these check cashers are really transaction-based. You know, the check cashing business model runs on doing a ton of small transactions. So one way that the president of RightCheck, Joe Coleman, put it to me was he said, look, a bank wants one customer with $1 million, and a check casher wants a million customers with $1.
Oh, wow.
So they're coming in a lot. They have a lot of interface. And there is, you know, they're kind of using it almost as this community resource. The neighborhood where I worked was largely Spanish-speaking, a lot of Dominicans and Puerto Ricans. Most of the transactions I did were in Spanish, and people would sometimes come in with a letter in English from the government that they needed translated and ask for some help. You know, they were really kind of using us as a way to navigate things, but there was a kind of friendliness. You know, people tipped us, which I was completely surprised about. They brought us coffee sometimes in the morning. They brought gifts to another teller who was there who had a baby during the time that I worked there. So there was this sense of, you know, kind of almost like they were regulars at a restaurant, and the tellers would anticipate the client's needs. The clients would kind of know that what they could expect. In fact, it took a while for people to be comfortable with me because I was new. And I really saw that happening day after day. So there was a comfort level and a sense of trust, rightly or wrongly, correctly or incorrectly. When we interviewed people after I finished doing the stint as a teller, a lot of people just didn't trust banks. And that's a place where the post office may come in, right? Because there is, I think, a sense of trust in the post office that there might not be for a bank.
And I want to pick up on that. But you also talk about the kind of transparency. I think anyone that has a bank account and tries to decipher and read through the materials that you're supposed to read through, and it sounds like at least at this check cashing place, things were written on the wall in kind of simple English, and perhaps people understood the transaction maybe better than we do at our banks.
I think that's right. Yeah, there's a big sign. I mean, and this is legislated by law, too. So it's got to be in this huge font, both at check cashers and payday lenders, that tells you there's a sense out there, I think, that people are being tricked into taking these services and not knowing. And that's exactly the opposite. They are expensive. But the signs are right there saying, you know, it's $15 per hundred. Here's the APR. It's triple digits. Here's how much it costs to pay a bill. It's almost like a menu where it's very clear. Whereas at the bank, people don't always know even if they say put their paycheck in on Friday, when exactly it's going to clear. Right. So if you put your paycheck in at 5 or 6 o'clock on Friday, you deposit it into your bank account. The bank doesn't take deposits 7 days a week. So it's not going to show up till Monday or Tuesday at the earliest. Meanwhile, if you're using your debit card over the weekend, that money does get withdrawn immediately. The banks do withdrawals 7 days a week. So you could be overdrawn. And people just feel like it's my money. Why can't I have it? You go to the check casher on Friday after work and you get your money. in cash. And a lot of people would stand at the window, you know, spread their bills out in front of me and kind of figure out how much cash they could apportion to each of the people that they owed money to. And oftentimes not pay the whole bill. You know, people would come with Con Ed shutoff notices and things like that because they were kind of figuring out how much can I pay without paying the whole thing to keep the lights on.
And getting what sounds like deeper and deeper in debt.
Oftentimes. And I think, you know, we tend to blame the businesses. We tend to blame the check cashers and the payday lenders. But one of the things that I really came out of my work feeling and thinking was that a big part of the problem is that people simply are not making enough money to make ends meet. Mm. And if you look at wages, real wages have declined since 1972. There's a lot of talk these days about raising the minimum wage. The gap between the minimum wage and the average hourly wage is the highest it's ever been now. And so that's a huge part of the problem. And if you take away all of these alternative financial services businesses, that demand is still going to be there. I certainly am not arguing that this is the best way to meet that demand, but I think we have to look at why the demand is escalating so much. And I think it's because people are simply in a really bad financial position. 76% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck.
76%.
Yes. Yes.
Three-quarters of Americans are living paycheck
right.
to paycheck. I'm also curious, in this particular neighborhood in the South Bronx, were there banks there?
There was a major bank about three blocks from where I worked. And where I worked in Oakland, California, there were two banks on the two-block commercial strip where the check cashier payday lender was located. So oftentimes, you know, one of the things you'll hear is that there are a lot of bank closings. And, in fact, in the last year or two, about 93% of branch closings have been in lower-income areas. So that's location and convenience is definitely a piece of this. However, even in neighborhoods where you see a check cashier and a bank on the same block, the check cashier is getting a fair amount of business.
Because people are using their feet to make a decision about their money?
That's right. They're making a choice. So I think there are two misperceptions. There are many, but two of them are, one, that this is all about supply and reining in supply, and the second is that the people who are using these businesses must be missing something, and they must simply need financial education, or they're not making an informed choice. And what we learned, we did about 100 interviews with customers, is that for the most part, they are making an informed choice. They simply don't have better options. So, you know, there's a difference between knowing what the options are and actually being able to use them.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to find out from you, Lisa Servan, what you think about this postal service banking idea. And she's a professor at the Milano School of International Affairs Management and Urban Policy at the New School. And as she has been telling us, spent about 4 months working at a cash checking service in the Bronx. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents The Capital Steps, February 19th through the 23rd. The Capital Steps are a musical troupe of former Capitol Hill staff members. This is an evening of hilarious musical parody that plays no favorites in scrutinizing today's most talked about political issues and scandals. The Capital Steps put the mock in democracy. The Capital Steps at Bristol Riverside Theater. Tickets at 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Through snow, sleet, ice, and freezing rain, we are here for you. Yes, the weather has been a mess in the last week, but that has not derailed our winter membership campaign here at WHYY. We will end it as soon as possible, and we will with your help. Please pick up the phone and make a pledge right now. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. What is news and information worth to you? $5, $10, $20 a month? You decide and then call 1-888-345-WHYY. And you can pledge online at our secure server, WHYY.org. We rely on you and other listeners for about half of our budget. That's the way we like it, and that's the way the public broadcasting, public media has worked for decades now. It's an unusual financial model, and it has been successful. So pick up the phone, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. What do you think of this idea, turning the post office into a kind of bank for the 68 million Americans who do not have a bank account? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Lisa Cervone, and we'll be talking with another guest in about 10 minutes or so, but we'd like to see what you think of this idea. So do you think this is a good idea, Lisa?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, the infrastructure is there. The services are not so complex, although certainly there would have to be a real retraining, et cetera. That, you know, internationally, there are a lot of examples where this works. And I think one of the most interesting things about it that speaks for it is that post offices are often in places where banks aren't, and they are in low-income communities. I read the proposal, the working paper, and the one question I had that's not fully fleshed out was, what's the financial model? So one of the ways that this is being sold is that it could be a revenue generator for the U.S. Postal Service. And I'm curious about what the charges would be, how the post office would set its fees and interest rates for the small loans it's talking about offering, given that that's such a big criticism of payday lenders. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, there have been a lot of nonprofits, kind of social justice-oriented entities that have tried to figure out how to do an alternative payday loan, and they just haven't really worked so far. There's some really interesting experimentation that could take off, but so far we don't see anybody who's been able to really make a go of it. So I wonder how the Postal Service is thinking about delivering a credit product that is less expensive than what's out there and still making a profit for the post office.
And what they're talking about are things like reloadable prepaid cards, some money transfers, small loans, and helping people put aside some money for savings.
That's right. Yes. And so a lot of those things are things that are already done by check cashers and payday lenders. The thing that that is not done in general is saving. And it's interesting because, you know, if you look back at the post office, there was a period between, I think, 1911 and 1967 in which the post office did help people save and partnered with banks. Some check cashers, for example, the one I worked at in the South Bronx, Right Check, does partner with a local credit union called BethEx and does enable people to save. So when they deposit their paycheck or cash their paycheck at the check cashier, they can put any amount of that check into a savings account. So I think Right Check and BethEx were very forward-looking. These are two entities that don't normally partner with each other. You know, the credit union is good and the check cashier is bad, but they really saw how they could work together and provide a service to their customers. So just to kind of put on the table that it's not out of the question that check cashers could do that too, but I think that savings aspect is important.
You know, I was looking at, again, going back to this report from the Inspector General, and when we're talking about 68 million American adults, we're talking about people in the working class, people in the middle class, low income, the unemployed, students, immigrants, and those who have been hit hard by the recession. That's a very diverse group of people.
It is.
With, I'm assuming, diverse needs as well.
I think so, yes. But, you know, I think some of those needs, a need for small dollar credit, a need for a way to save. You know, banks, without being very differentiated, have served a pretty diverse group so far. But I think one of the things this Postal Service proposal is recognizing is that there are still categories. There are people who maybe banking is not necessarily the answer. So, you know, what the post office is offering or proposing is something that's not identical to a bank, but looks much more like a check cashier or a payday lender. And in that respect, is kind of acknowledging that there is kind of a spectrum of needs.
But do you think, you know, big,
and that the post office might be able to fill them.
But do you think these big traditional banks, I guess all banks are pretty big these days, but these banks, do they want these customers, these unbanked customers, these relatively probably low income customers?
You know, I think it's really hard to see that they're trying very hard given their record. over the past 10 years or so, for example, almost every kind of fee banks charge has increased. ATM fees have gone up. Overdraft fees have gone up. You want to get your card replaced, your ATM card, it's gone up. Minimum balances have gone up. Between 2009 and 2011, in just those 2 years, the number of truly free checking accounts went from something like 71% of all checking accounts to 39%. Right. So they're not necessarily doing what one would think they would do if they really wanted this type of consumer. And as I said before, it's partly based on their business model, right? They don't make money from doing lots of small transactions. They make money from having large deposits. Now, that's not to say that I think banks should be let off the hook, but it's unclear what we need to do to get banks in the game. Now, maybe with this post office, it would be thought of as kind of almost like a partnership, right, where the post office is serving the lower income consumer that's doing a lot of transactions, and then they kind of graduate to a bank. That's kind of what's happening now with check cashers and payday lenders, except that we see that it's not always a straight line from being unbanked or underbanked to being just banked. A lot of people going in and out of the banking system using both at the same time. And again, I think that the question is, will the post office be able to deliver these services at a price that the public thinks is fair, given that it thinks that the price that check cashers and payday lenders are charging is not fair?
And I will probably put that question to our second guest who is waiting in the wings. We do have an email from Mike saying, I lived in England for three to five years and used their postal system for all sorts of things, including banking and insurance. It was terrific. And as you said, Lisa, this is a model that has been used in other countries.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So I think there is potential. I think, you know, a lot of times in these sorts of things, the devil is in the details. And, you know, certainly some of these elements like service, like being able to serve different neighborhoods would be critical the way that check cashers and payday lenders are doing now.
But it is interesting to be having this conversation as we go to a more cashless society. At least it feels that way.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, actually the business model of check cashers is being threatened. Those in, for example, states like New York where payday lending is illegal because there are far fewer checks. Last April, the government stopped issuing paper Social Security checks and other kinds of government checks. Mm-hmm. Lots more employers are only doing direct deposit or depositing onto prepaid cards. And so there are far fewer checks. Lots more people dealing in plastic and even using prepaid cards instead of bank accounts in some cases to manage their money. So that's happening for sure. At the same time, there's still a need for a lot of these transaction-based services. All the immigrants sending money to Guatemala, Mexico, wherever they're coming from, using money orders, and the prepaid cards are growing in terms of their usage.
Well, Lisa Cervon, thank you so much for getting our conversation started in this hour of Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And she's a professor at the Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. And part of what we talked about is some research that she did working for 4 months at a cash checking service in the South Bronx. Joining us now is Sheldon Guerin, and he's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University. And he wrote a book called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. And he has studied postal banking in the United States and overseas. And Sheldon Guerin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Martin. Nice to be on again.
Nice to have you on again. And do you think this is an idea whose time has come, the idea of the postal service providing banking services?
Well, yes. And of course, it's ironic because it was an idea of the 19th century, but one that's very much alive in the rest of the world, both the First World and Third World. The United States is quite exceptional in not having any sort of postal financial services at this point.
And I'm sure there's a long reason why that is, but why is that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that this idea of postal savings starts in Europe in the middle of the 19th century, the 1800s, starts in England in 1861, spreads very rapidly in the next 20 years or so, even to Japan, which today has the largest postal savings bank, also the largest bank. But when it spread, most other countries didn't have very strong commercial banking sectors. But the United States, by the 1870s, when it was first proposed here, had a very large commercial banking sector and quite well organized. And they vociferously fought efforts in Congress for nearly 40 years to pass a postal savings law. And finally, in 1910, a very weak one was passed, largely because there had been a big financial panic in 1907, much like the 2008 crisis. And a lot of people wanted to have a more secure government savings bank. But so it's been really opposition from the commercial banks, also from state rights advocates and others that didn't want this centralized postal savings system.
But do you think the system is equipped to do what at least this white paper presents, which is reloadable prepaid cards, money transfers, small loans, and a program to foster savings? Is the post office equipped to do that, you think?
Well, I think they're more than equipped to do it. They have been handling money orders, both domestic and international, throughout this period. And they also have an electronic international transfer system to a number of South American and Central American countries. So they have been handling money for a long time. It's not very sophisticated, what we're talking about. Somehow people think that it would be very difficult to set up an ATM in a post office. And yet every day in convenience stores, ATMs are set up and nobody pauses over that. It's very rudimentary. When I was 20 years old, I actually worked as a postal clerk when I was in college. They taught me in about 1 hour how to handle money orders. It's just not that hard. In our banks, tellers aren't superbly trained. They're given fairly minimal training and they start right in. We're not talking about complicated transactions there.
But it's interesting because this idea is posed on the one hand to save money and to help people who are quote unquote unbanked, and also to try to help save the postal service. Is it possible, do you think, to do both?
I think it is, because what happened is around the end of the 20th century, there were predictions that in all these countries in Europe and Japan that had postal savings systems, that this would be outmoded, the banks would replace them. And then post offices all over the world discovered that as their revenues declined from delivery services, from the traditional mail, that if they actually expanded the array of postal financial services beyond just postal savings and into prepaid cards and debit cards, sometimes credit cards, they actually found in the last 15 years or so that this has been a godsend to their finances. And this is true everywhere. Japan, France, Belgium, Germany, all sorts of places, it's been a real revenue and profit generator. So I don't think it would be difficult. And there's an advantage the post office has that Lisa was talking about, you know, foundations setting up pilot projects and trying to replicate the, you know, the alternative financial industry. But the post office has an advantage of tremendous economies of scale. It's very large. Its volume would be large. So I don't think it's going to be a problem at all. Well, now, there is a question.
Go ahead.
There is a question of how to balance the profit maximization needs of the post office against the public interest needs of the underbanked and the unbanked. And that's something that I think we have to discuss very seriously. It should not be the goal of the post office to replicate the banking sector in charging high fees. The fees should be reasonably low, enough to be viable for the post office, but the most important goal is a social goal, to really bring people back into the financial system.
Well, and that's the question I think that Lisa Servone had, which is that can you, in a sense, supply the services that people need and also be profitable? Because as she said, there have been some experiments that they haven't necessarily gone so well.
Well, I mean, the experiment – in America, we experiment. Everybody in the rest of the world does it,
okay.
And they found it's very viable.
Okay.
So, I guess I have to laugh sometime because this is just going on everywhere, and it's been a big success. But Americans love to experiment.
Yes, we do. Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know what you think of this idea. It's an idea that is getting some traction, the idea of helping the millions of people that don't have a bank account in this country. They use financial services, which is to help the post office provide some of these services to them. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me get Brahman from, looks like, Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thank you for being on the show. I love
sure.
the show.
Thank you.
The topic at hand, you answered both of my questions. Was one was, how would this be managed, staff, and who, you know, what kind of organization is it to have a bank in the post office? And two, is this an initiative to try to salvage the post office? And you know, moving forward, would this be developed into another federal bank from the post office, or are we going to turn this into a bank? And would it end up being two different entities?
Brahman, let me give Sheldon Guerin a chance to respond from his perspective. What do you think, Sheldon? Yeah, thanks for the call, Brahman.
It's a very good question. If you look at the Inspector General's report from the Postal USPS that came out a couple of weeks ago, he and his staff were very careful to call it non-bank financial services. And they said, we are not going to be competing as a bank, which means that as they have proposed it, you wouldn't have a full-scale savings account and things like that. Instead, you would tend to rely on prepaid cards. Now, those are the details, and we don't know how it's going to come out, but it could very well turn into something that looked like a bank, or alternatively, it could be marketing various products like prepaid cards in partnership with private sector financial companies. That's a very viable proposal, and then it would be less of a bank. In other words, if you had a prepaid card, the pool of funds would actually be held by a bank somewhere and FDIC insured. So the point is, we don't exactly know what they're proposing now. My guess is, politically speaking, it'll be a lot easier to market it as a non-bank, even if it does appear to be a bank.
Well, it's interesting. I'm looking at an article from American Banker and describing this as the worst idea since the Edsel. Do you think this idea, though, is up against the banking lobby that sees this as a threat?
Well, the banking lobby will always see it as a threat. We should not be surprised. When I was Googling a few articles in the New York Times, I thought I was Googling recent things, but I got a 1909 article before the first postal savings law was passed. And it is a conference of the American Bankers Association, which is still with us, headline, says postal savings will hurt people. And, I mean, they didn't quite have an Edsel then, but I'm sure they would have used exactly the same term. So the banks have, since the 1870s, used the argument it will compete with them. But as you just discussed with Professor Servan, the banks, ironically, don't actually seem to be interested in most of this business from lower-income people, immigrants, and young people. So it's an odd argument that they're worried about competition when they themselves won't compete.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We have a lot of callers that want to join us as well. That's Sheldon Guerin. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University. In fact, the last time he was on the show, we were talking about Hiroshima. He's the author of a book called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends, Why the World Saves. And we are talking about postal banking. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We want to end this winter membership campaign, and we will when we meet our overall goal. The weather has thrown off our schedule, but we can get on track when you make your pledge of support. Here's that phone number, and I know you know it by now. It's 1-888-345-9499. And you can pledge online at whyy.org at our secure server. Today, we're reimagining the post office. Could it also be a bank for the millions who don't have a bank account? And dressing down. We're talking about the popularity of casual attire. But are sweats and flip-flops appropriate dress for work? two very different shows, which is what we do 5 days a week here on Radio Times. We're curious about many things, and we know you are too. So support the radio you listen to. Support Radio Times. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. 1-888-345-WHYY. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Sheldon Guerin about the idea of postal banking, an idea that he has been talking about and supporting. And it's an idea that perhaps is getting some traction with a recent report from the Postal Service, the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service. Let me see what looks like Bob from West Philadelphia has to say. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hi there. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
Listen, my only concern is that I know when I walk into my local check cashier, which is also a source of transit token, SEPTA, you wait in a pretty long line to get those tokens, depending on time of day, of course. If you go to my post office for something as simple to buy stamps, there's one window open, occasionally two, but that person, if they're not on break, is looking for someone's package, often for 15 or 20 minutes. So that if you take all the people out of the line at the check cashing place and then put them into the line at the post office, you're looking at maybe an hour wait, or are they going to expand the size of our post offices and the workforce to provide these services?
Bob, I appreciate that. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to what you're talking about. Sheldon Guerin, that's customer service, is it not?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's a job creator, but we'll see.
Well, we'll see. Let me see what Sheldon Guerin. Go ahead, Sheldon. Go ahead.
Well, yes. I mean, in most countries, in Europe and Japan, you do have separate windows and separate clerks who handle the postal saving, and that's the appropriate way to do it. You wouldn't want the same people handling the stamps who are handling that. So it may involve maybe hiring more people, which would not be a bad thing, actually. Post offices used to be bigger, and, you know, when we go into our local post office, we notice there are many windows that are no longer being used. So, you know, once those windows were manned. So that may not be a bad thing, expanded business, expanded employment. But it's also important to realize that while people do like to do their transactions often in person, the fact of the matter is most ordinary transactions will be done at the ATM. So it won't be much different than a regular bank in that respect, or a 7-Eleven for that matter.
Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Rosemary from Princeton has to say. Rosemary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thank you for shedding some light on the subject. I'm coming at this from a slightly different perspective. You know, in Princeton, where your guest is from and where I live, the post office has been recently sold to a hedge fund in California and will now become a 100-seat restaurant. And so a beautiful WPA building paid for by taxpayer dollars will now be a building you can only enter if you can afford to dine there. Okay, that is a separate issue.
Okay.
The point is that the government, the Congress legislated, I believe in 2006, that the post office must pay forward for benefits for employees whom they don't even employ yet, and that they may not compete with, say, UPS and FedEx in terms of business models. And some people, myself included, understand this as a way of trying to shrink the postal union, which is, embattled and a very strong union. And so we all have this idea that the post office is being sort of, we really don't get as much mail anymore, which I don't know about you, but my mailbox is always full. So how would these legislative mandates affect proposition?
Rosemary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Sheldon Guerin, as we know, the post office has been losing money, and they are required to sort of pay ahead for future benefits. Does that complicate how you view this issue?
Well, it certainly makes the job much harder, and I agree entirely with Rosemary on this respect. And other countries, of course, don't have this 2006 Act, which as she said, one commits the post office to putting aside assets for, I believe it's 75 years. It's just unimaginable. Nobody else, no other organization would have that. So this was an attempt, you would have to say, to cripple the post office as a public service, probably to shrink the postal union. I don't have a lot of doubt about that. And part of the legislation also said, this 2006 Act, that the post office going forward must not introduce any new non-postal services. So that's where this, the proposal by the Inspector General is politically interesting. It sounds like a new non-postal service.
Sure does.
The Inspector General says no, because the legislation did grandfather in existing services such as money orders, domestic and international. Since those are financial services, he believes, or his staff believes, that it should be legally possible to do this without a revision of the 2006 law. So anyway, there are two points here, but going back to Rosemary's point, it would be a lot nicer and a lot better public policy if the 2006 Act were revised and this crippling requirement for the pensions was removed. Because if that were removed, all of a sudden, post office would more or less be breaking even. And then with financial services, they'd be better than breaking even. So we need to take that into consideration, too.
Rosemary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Sheldon, I'll put to you what I put to Lisa about the fact that we live in a much more, I guess, cashless society, or much less, you know, cash-driven society. Do you think if we're talking about digital transfers and credit cards and debit cards, that that also fits into the model that you're looking at for the Postal Service?
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, it's not so much my model. It's what the Inspector General
right.
actually proposes in this white paper. We are moving toward cashless. We're moving away from checks, thank goodness, because they're actually very expensive. and so all of it's good to move to plastic. Anyway, it's happening whether we like it or not. And the post office offers the hope with, you know, these various prepaid cards or debit cards that for the first time, people who are low income, young people, are going to be able to do a lot more in terms of the e-economy, the e-commerce, than they could. I mean, imagine if you don't have a credit card or a debit card, how do you buy things online? It's very difficult. So it can do a lot in terms of this move toward a cashless society by including people who right now are either excluded or pay a very high price to be included.
And I'm assuming you're talking about these reloadable debit cards, things like that?
Right. So prepaid cards is what the post office is proposing. A prepaid card is not tied to a bank account. Personally, I like the idea of people having a savings account. I think it's more concrete and things like that. But the fact of the matter is that banks are charging a lot for actual accounts now, and a prepaid card for a lower-income person or young person is a much cheaper alternative. You just pay an upfront cost, then you reload it. There are usually fairly small fees, although they can be large in the private sector. But the post office would have reasonable fees. So that's the way they're proposing.
Let me see what looks like Paul from Newtown Square has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning, Marty.
Morning.
And yes, it's a wonderful show.
Thank you.
I grew up in England and used the postal service for banking. Just two points. I don't know why anybody here is crazy enough to put personal money into any bank other than a credit union, because I put my personal money in a credit union and I've got absolutely no charges. The fees are minimal. Kind of online transactions cost nothing. And you're basically an association that owns the bank. The banks, the major banks, of course, fought that a few years ago big time, tried to put a stop to the federal credit unions because they do represent a real threat, I think, competitively to them. But as a kid in England, the Post Office Savings Bank enabled children to actually start saving early. I had a newspaper route. I made 12 shillings and sixpence a week, and I probably put 5 shillings a week. And you'd just go to the window, and they'd give you 5 shillings worth of stamps. You put them on the page. After a certain amount of time, you got a pound on a page, and it felt wonderful, and you felt rich, and you went around with this cache of money that you were going to do great things with someday. But I think it also gets children into savings and not these frivolously spending everything. I say, three cheers for the post office. I just hope politically we can get it done.
Well, that's an interesting story there, Paul. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sheldon, your response, your thoughts.
Yeah, Paul is completely right. And that's a big point that I developed in my book, but that youth and children's saving is really important in terms of teaching people habits of saving and spending and responsible saving and spending. And postal savings in most countries was really tied to school-based, what they used to call school savings banks. So you'd bring your money in, maybe Paul did this, bring it into to school each once a week, and then it would be transferred over in your account in the local post office savings bank. It sounds like he was from England, although I wasn't quite clear about that. So it's actually very important, and I think the Inspector General probably doesn't make a big enough point about it. We're not simply talking about lower income people. We are talking about young people in general, even people from, relatively middle class homes who it's not that easy to have a small savers account. As a teenager, in fact, younger than 17, it's actually even illegal to have an account that you can actually manage yourself, that you can withdraw on. So, it's something that it's going to involve some legislation, because there's also minimum age things and that are at play. But indeed, I think postal savings could be or postal financial services could be a very good way of bringing people at a young age into the financial system.
Do you think, though, that and you referenced this earlier, that the political environment is open to this? And it seems like any time the Postal Service comes up, the critics come out and just lambast this service. Do you think there's any hope for this idea that we've been talking about?
I do think there's hope.
Do you?
Politics is interesting. 18 months ago, I actually gave a lecture on postal savings to in one of the U.S. Congress House office buildings, congressional staffers. At the time, everybody said that I was far out. They didn't quite call me a lunatic, but they said, this is crazy. And they said, don't you understand politics in this country? It's never going to happen. And I believe the Postal Service was part of the crowd that denounced it. Well, here we are, 18 months later.
Yeah.
The U.S. Postal Service is looking at themselves in a lot of trouble. They have gotten new ideas from foundations and social policy people. And lo and behold, to my utter surprise, the political climate changed a bit. Now we're actually talking about it rather than talking about it as some lunatic foreign idea. So whether we get to the next step or not, it depends. But, if I were in Washington, and I'm not, I'm actually in Berlin right now, but if I were in Washington and I were in the White House, I might see this as an interesting opportunity to have a discussion and let the banks denounce it, and then I think the White House or the administration should say, and what are you, the banks, doing to serve the underbanked? If you've got a better idea, tell us, because the banks have not been pressed to do that. So I would never say never. It took 40 years the first time. Hopefully it won't take 40 years this time. But I do think politics changes.
Well, we are talking about the underbanked, the people that don't have bank accounts, and whether the Postal Service could provide services for them. And again, Sheldon Guerin is our guest. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University. He wrote a book called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends, While the World Saves. And I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get to, it looks like Deb from Riverton, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Deb, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Good morning to your guests as well. So my husband and I recently spent 5 months in France, and in France you have La Poste and also the Postal Bank. We found that it was very convenient for people in the various villages where we stayed, and not only was this bank providing many services more than we provide here, but also it became a real community center. So after Village Market, the post office was where people would gather.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Deb, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Sheldon, I know you have looked at a number of countries. You're in Germany yourself, and you mentioned the Japanese model. It seems that we could perhaps borrow some ideas from these countries.
Yes, and I mean, Deb mentions France. France and Japan are like the two really large postal savings systems. And the French system, in terms of trying to encourage people to save and involving people in the financial system, it and the Japanese are tops. In France, there's an official policy called financial inclusion. Banks must offer low-cost services to lower-income people. The post office and postal savings in France is just superb in terms of that. And in France, something like 99% of households have some type of bank or postal bank account. And postal savings has been a big part of that story. You know, compare it to us, where we have 28% either banked or underbanked. We're talking about a place where there's 1% that is unbanked. So it's quite an institution. In France, in fact, they even go further. The government actually sets the rate of interest that are paid on savings accounts, and it's now 1.25%. Which makes the French angry because they think it's so low, but you try getting 1.25% here.
Well, that is true, and we're almost out of time here, and you're in Germany, and you've described that as semi-privatized. How is that? How does that work in 30 seconds or less?
Okay. Well, they have a Postbank. They don't have as old postal savings as most people, but they adopted it about a half century ago. But then it actually, because they have so many other wonderful savings banks, was less of a need. The Postbank got bought up by Deutsche Bank, but it still has an obligation to be accessible, and it's still very popular with the public, and it offers a big array of services, partly in partnership with Deutsche Bank and its affiliates.
Well, I so appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Sheldon Guerin, thanks so much, and have fun in Berlin, whatever you're doing
Thank
there.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, he's a professor at Princeton University, wrote a book called Beyond Our Means. We also talk with Lisa Servan, and she's a professor of urban policy at the New School's Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy, talking about the Postal Service getting into the banking business. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and tell us what you think of this discussion. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.